of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We'll begin today with What Is It About Ranch Dressing? Written by Ellen Cushing. As far as I can tell, Patient Zero was a Swedish 24-year-old named Elsa Thora. Why did no one tell me ranch sauce is like crack? She posted to X earlier this month, apparently hours after landing in Indianapolis for a month-long World Cup trip. Europe, we need ranch, ASAP. The post received 49,000 likes and propelled Thora to a very specific kind of fame. I guess I'm that ranch girl now, she says in her bio on Instagram, where she is also doing sponsored content for a Curacao-based online casino that takes only cryptocurrency. She was also, as my colleague Will Oramus recently pointed out, a star of both OnlyFans and the British tabloids before any of this. Soon enough, ever more World Cup fans are being charmed by ranch, and more Americans were being charmed by them being charmed. By late last week, the TSA had issued a statement. If you're visiting for a large sporting event and you happen to discover ranch while you're here, please pack it in your checked bag on the way home. Shortly thereafter, Kraft posted a partially AI-generated image of a supposedly TSA-compliant mini ranch packets, plus a promise that more details on how to buy them would be coming soon. No matter that the product did not actually exist yet, and that the desire for it had been ginned up in the Internet's post-truth hall of mirrors, news stories about Kraft's stunt sprouted up like weeds after a summer rain. The cycle continued, more videos, more coverage, more social media posts. There's no real reason that a police department in suburban Northern California needed to post on Facebook about a coordinated international enthusiasm for ranch dressing, except for the obvious. They wanted to get in on the fun. Ranch mania is broadly endearing because it combines so many of the Internet's favorite things, influencers, AI slop, food opinions, low-stakes cultural differences, close-up shots of fatty liquids spilling out of their containers, feel-good alternatives, dumb new things to buy. The news stories are too credulous and too the influencers are too savvy, but I find that a little winsome too. It's as though the Internet is putting on a play and everyone is working desperately to make sure it goes right. Coordinated international enthusiasm is hard to come by these days, after all. The only two things that reliably seem to bring it are food and sports. And ranch is, truly, one of America's great indigenous foods. In the early 1950s, Steve Henson was living in Alaska, working as a plumbing contractor. He also sometimes cooked for his crew, but he had trouble finding fresh herbs or dairy up there, so he had to make do with what he had. He made a dressing with buttermilk, mayonnaise, and various dried herbs and spices, notably onion and garlic powder. The blend came home to his native Nebraska with him, and then to the Dude Ranch in Santa Barbara that he and his wife later founded, which they called Hidden Valley. Their patrons loved it. World War II-era technology had recently enabled the easy packaging and preserving of food. This was the era of the boxed cake mix, too. So the Hensons started selling powdered ranch by mail. It became so popular that every room in their house was soon filled with packets, and they had to close the Dude Ranch. In the early 1980s, the home products company Clorox, which the Hensons had sold their business to, helped pioneer shelf-stable liquid ranch, which quickly made its way to grocery store shelves around the country. A few years later, snack food makers began putting the spice blend on chips. By the early 90s, ranch officially took over Italian to become America's best-selling salad dressing. It still is. At a restaurant in St. Louis, every entree item, including nachos and mac and cheese, contains ranch. At the Minnesota State Fair, you can buy ranch-flavored cream cheese that is coated in panko and deep-fried, then dusted in ranch powder. Just this past weekend, when the Dallas Cowboys tight end Jake Ferguson got married at the Biltmore Hotel in Miami, he presented his guests with a ranch fountain. In season 12 of The Simpsons, when Homer is dying of carbon monoxide poisoning, he hallucinates himself as a sultan, surrounded by dancing concubines. But that's not actually the fantasy. Eventually, he barks, "Enough! I grow weary of your sexual suggestive dancing. Bring me my ranch dressing hose." And he then takes a fireman's hose of it straight to the face, happily. Some 75% of Americans like or love ranch, according to a 2025 report from the food industry analyst Data Essential. Meanwhile, packaged food manufacturers have gotten very good at reworking ranch into novel flavor combinations and familiar products. Hot Pockets, lip balm, ice cream. The U.S. loves ranch so much that it has become a metonym for the country itself. Overseas, Cool Ranch Doritos are called Cool American. That the international soccer fans and social media grifters currently falling in love with ranch can typically experience it only in that form, powdered atop a chip, is one of the prosaic tragedies of our market-driven global food system. Ranch just isn't popular enough outside the U.S. to justify shipping and stocking it elsewhere, beyond a few specialty stores and the odd American aisle. Other cultures have similar-ish sauces, Indian raita, Greek tzatziki, English salad cream. But there is nothing exactly like ranch. Gloopy, dilly, cool, perfect. In 1995, the social psychologist Michael Billing coined the term banal nationalism to cover all the mundane ways we live out our national identities. Sports is one of them, incidentally, but so is food. The ways that we buy, sell, consume, and talk about food can demarcate and sustain the emotive power of national attachment, the sociologist Michaela DeSoucy writes. Americans like ranch because it's delicious, and because companies are good at selling it to us, and because it's ours. We like the recent wave of ranch stories because they are funny, but mostly because they make us feel good. They remind us that this country can serve as a source of delight for the rest of the world, that we can make things that feel worth taking back home and sharing. Compared with European food, American food tends to be liked, but not respected. And that's only when it's not being blamed for actively immiserating the world. The ranch memes are like the photo negative of the Fry Festival. Visitors come from all over the world for a massive entertainment event, but instead of being disappointed, they are amazed by something totally tangential. Bring me my ranch dressing hose. Our second story, Long Live Mel Brooks, by Adrian LaFrance. If you want to understand Mel Brooks, and I mean really understand him, a good place to start is with Nikolai Gogol's unfinished masterpiece, Dead Souls. This is the 1842 novel that Brooks, at his most sentimental, has returned to again and again and again. If you know even a little bit about Gogol and a little bit about Brooks, each is a brilliant, obsessive, absurdist maximalist in his own way. This connection will make immediate sense. People sometimes call Gogol the father of Russian realism, yet in Dead Souls especially, he explores the human condition with the unmistakable verve of a comedian, seizing on preposterousnesses hidden in plain sight, piling absurdities atop one another until the tension cannot hold, generally dazzling the reader with his originality and playfulness. Brooks came to Gogol in the early 1950s on the recommendation of a mentor, the TV writer Mel Tolkien, while they were both working on the sketch comedy sensation Your Show of Shows. As Brooks remembers it, in a story he's told repeatedly, Tolkien urged him to read Dead Souls, saying, "Even though you're an animal from Brooklyn, I think you have the beginnings of a mind." Incidentally, Gogol ends the novel mid-sentence in just the way that Brooks once, in search of a punchline that never came to him, broke off in the middle of a riotously funny monologue and walked out, not just of the room, but of the party he was attending. Tolkien appears to be the mentor who said of Brooks, "Half of Mel's creativity comes out of fear and anger. He doesn't perform, he screams." This was an era in which a still unknown Brooks would show up late to the writer's room, a habit that drove his colleagues nuts, and then get the biggest laughs out of them anyway. He's an outrageously funny and had unbelievable range. One minute he'd be doing an impression of a rabbi, and the next he was writhing around on the floor, pretending to be a harpooned whale, a Melville reference, naturally. The playwright Neil Simon, also a writer on the show, called Brooks the most uniquely funny man I've ever met. So Brooks, ever on a quest to prove himself, liked that Tolkien saw him as an intellectual, or at least a could-be intellectual. And it turned out that Brooks liked Gogol, too. Over the years, he certainly liked telling people how much he liked Gogol, who comes up in interview after interview. When Mel Brooks decides that he likes something, or that he wants something, he really cannot be stopped. I've been thinking about Brooks lately because he turns 100 today. This was written the end of May. A fact that should mostly be understood as indelible proof of a beneficent universe. Evidence of how ungodly lucky we are all to have shared, even for one day, let alone many decades, the same atmosphere as one of the true greats of our species. Mel Brooks gave us, among other comedic gifts, The Producers, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, Silent Movie, High Anxiety, Spaceballs, History of the World Part 1, and Robin Hood Men in Tights. You could have been born at any point in time, but here you are alive when ice cream, antibiotics, and indoor plumbing have all been invented, and Mel Brooks is turning 100. If that isn't extraordinarily good luck, I don't know what is. To be funny at all is something of a miracle. No form of writing is more difficult. No genre of art requires more daring. And no one can fake it, although many try. Mel Brooks' contributions to American comedy are a miracle a few times over, in that he is quite possibly the funniest man who ever lived, and yet you can still easily see how it could have gone the other way. Brooks was born on a hot summer day in 1926 in Brooklyn, the youngest of four boys, Irving, Lenny, Bernie, and Mel, raised during the Great Depression by a single mother. His father died suddenly when Mel was still a toddler. Brooks, who was born Melvin Kaminsky, remembers his childhood as phenomenally happy. Endless days of egg creams at the neighborhood soda fountain and stickball games in the street, an apartment filled with home-cooked meals and the sound of his mother singing along to Irving Berlin, special trips to Coney Island for root beer and hot dogs, and, once his mother returned enough milk bottles to afford them, 10-cent double features at the movie house on Friday nights, where he ate salami sandwiches packed from home. "I loved my childhood in Brooklyn," Brooks recalls in his memoir, All About Me, My Remarkable Life in Show Business. He often thinks of it as the happiest period of his life. Brooks also relished his role as a class clown, terrorizing his teachers and leaving his friends gasping with laughter. Being funny came naturally to him, obviously, but it was also about self-preservation. Most of the kids in my class were taller than me. I needed a weapon to protect myself. The weapon turned out to be comedy, Brooks wrote. He took up drumming, quickly learning that playing well, like telling a good joke, requires an exquisite sense of timing. Side note, here's a fun fact about how Melvin Kaminsky became Mel Brooks. He intended to change Kaminsky to his mother's name, Brookman, but all the letters in Brookman wouldn't fit on the drums, so Brooks it was. When Brooks was 14 years old, he got a job at a Borscht Belt hotel as a busboy manning the sour cream station. After hours, he would race between hotels to catch the acts of various comedians doing stand-up on the Catskills circuit. Eventually, he got on stage himself and began to do impressions. One of James Madison mainly consisted of him pretending to be the fourth president, quarreling over the mundane with his wife, Dolly. I'll do stuff like, "Dolly, hurry, set out the fruit salad. Franklin and Jefferson will be here any minute." He also started his act with a song that simultaneously is a relic of the Borscht Belt and holds up pretty well as an encapsulation of the fuel that has kept Brooks going all these years. "Here I am, Melvin Brooks. I've come to stop the show. Just a ham who's minus looks, but in your hearts I'll grow. I'll tell you gags, sing you songs, happy little snappy tunes that roll along. Out of my mind, won't you be kind, and please love Melvin Brooks." Brooks was still practically a baby when he joined the Army Reserves and was shipped off to France during World War II. He got lucky many times over, not least of all because he wasn't deployed until the war was nearly over. But the experience was still surreal, often terrifying. Although never one to miss the opportunity for a joke, he told Judd Apatow in a 2023 interview for this magazine that, in the end, fighting in World War II was better than facing a tough Jewish audience in the Catskills. During combat, Brooks couldn't quite believe what was happening around him. For one thing, he felt like he was suddenly living inside of a newsreel, and for another, he couldn't comprehend why humanity would stoop so terribly low. In one close call, he found himself in an encounter with some Germans blasting off cannons. "We were in a command car," he recalled in an interview in 1998, "and the road blew up around us, and I said, 'Why do they hate us? We don't even know them. Why are they so angry?'" The late critic Kenneth Tynan put it in his spectacular Brooks profile for The New Yorker in 1978. "To be Jewish, Brooklyn-born, fatherless, impoverished, and below average stature, no more classic recipe could be imagined for an American comedian, or one might suppose for an American suicide. I'll add to that, to fight in World War II to confront the worst of humanity and to survive, that is difficult enough. But to take those experiences and explode them into a comic rapture, to see what Hitler wrought and then dream up the producers, to confront death and choose humor, to adore the literary greats but reject any modicum of pretension. This is the miracle of Mel Brooks." Brooks once said that he went into show business to make a noise, to pronounce myself. He didn't just want to make a noise, but to make the loudest noise to the most people. "And if I can't do that," he concluded, "I'm not going to make a quiet, exquisite noise." But I always liked best how Gene Wilder, Brooks' captivating leading funny man, put it. In the actor's mind's eye, Brooks was always standing bare-chested on top of a mountain, shouting, "Look at me," and "Don't let me die." This is why Brooks' work, his writing, his directing, of course his own performances, is defined by a sense of total abandon. No joke that can go far enough. No spectacle can be too big. Wild ambition is coupled with an insistence on living in the moment. And it's the same quality that first captured the attention of Anne Bancroft, who was far more famous than Brooks when they first met in the early 1960s. That evening, Bancroft had been asked to sing for the NBC variety show Kraft Music Hall, and Brooks approached her after her performance at the Ziegfeld Theater, saying, as Bancroft always remembered it, "I'm Mel Brooks. Hiya, eh?" Just like that, she recalled, according to Douglas Daniels' biography of her and Bancroft, A Life. "He talks like that. I liked him." Fast forward to 1964, and they were married at City Hall in New York. For their wedding night meal, Bancroft cooked spaghetti for them at home. Yet as endearingly low-key as the couple could seem, nothing ever felt ordinary about their romance. Bancroft often described Brooks as literally incandescent, so charismatic that he practically glowed. They would stay together for 41 years until her death in 2005. "She had good taste in everything except husbands," Brooks once said with typical self-effacement. When someone asked him why he never remarried, he was far more earnest. "Once you're married to Anne Bancroft, others don't seem to be appealing." Brooks often comes across as ebullient, but don't mistake ebullience for being carefree. His closest friends have always described him as intensely competitive, and as he became famous, he developed a reputation for being fiercely private, understandably so. Even his enthusiasm for Gogol came from a place of insecurity. Brooks sometimes tells the story of how, when he very first saw his name as a writer on the credits of Your Show of Shows, he felt like a fraud. "I got scared, and I figured I'd better find out what those bastards do." Brooks tromped to the library and checked out an armful of classics. Gogol, but also Conrad, Dostoevsky, and Tolstoy. In other instances, when people have remarked on his literary leanings, Brooks has demurred. Sure, he kept a giant portrait of Tolstoy hanging above his desk at his Hollywood studio. And yes, he named Gene Wilder's character in The Producers, Leo Bloom, after James Joyce's protagonist in Ulysses. But Brooks will still insist that the best of cinema is every bit as good, or maybe even better, than the best of literature. La Grande Illusion is as good as Anna Karenina, but Les Enfants du Paradis is in the same class as La Chartreuse de Parn, he told the New York Times in 1978. "I'm a populist. I want color. I want visual images. I want the sound of the human voice." As much as Brooks loves novels and novelists, Joseph Heller was a dear friend, as was Mario Puzo, he loves other comedians more. "Growing up, he was obsessed with the Three Stooges and the Marx Brothers. They showed me that comedy is a juxtaposition of textures," he said in Apatow's extraordinary recent documentary about Brooks, Mel Brooks, the 99-year-old man. The Ritz brothers were like gods to Brooks, and he had a special affection for Harry Ritz, who had a physical insanity with freedom that no other performer ever had. That level of daring and the enormous laughs it would generate was the high that Brooks has chased ever since. Carl Reiner was famously his best friend, in addition to being the straight man to his Brooks's 2,000-year-old man, one of his most enduring characters. More than 60 years after the public first heard the bit, it remains as hilarious and contemporary feeling as it did from day one. Before Reiner died in 2020 at 98 years old, he would sometimes reminisce about the early years when he and Brooks would test out new ideas at parties. Reiner would come up with a character for Brooks, but wouldn't give him any hint ahead of time of what it would be. "I always tried for something that would force him to go into panic," Reiner recalled in one interview, "because a brilliant mind in panic is a wonderful thing to see." Brooks and Wilder were extremely close as well, basically brothers, although Wilder saw Brooks as more of a father figure. He taught me never to be afraid of offending, Wilder once recalled. It's when you worry about offending people that you get in trouble. Brooks also taught Wilder how to take something funny, push it all the way to the point of absurdity, and then keep going. Think, for example, of Wilder's manic portrayal of Bloom in one of the early scenes in The Producers. I'm hysterical. I'm having hysterics. I'm hysterical. I can't stop when I get like this. I can't stop. I'm hysterical. Zero Mostel as Max Bialystok then splashes a glass of water at Bloom to snap him out of it. Without missing a beat, Wilder. I'm wet. I'm wet. I'm hysterical and I'm wet. Max slaps him. Wilder again. I'm in pain and I'm wet and I'm still hysterical. Wilder used to keep a photo of him with Brooks in his office. It was inscribed, "To my son Gene with love, Daddy Mel." In his autobiography, Wilder put it this way, "If I hadn't met Mel Brooks, I would probably be a patient in some neuropsychiatric hospital today." Brooks talks about their work together in similarly existential terms. Brooks didn't make Blazing Saddles, for instance, because he was trying to be funny. It's just that humor is the lens through which Brooks processes everything. I think I can say anything serious via comedy. Brooks looked at the way Westerns had always been told, saw it as simply a lie, and decided he wanted to expose that lie in the most ridiculous and funniest way possible. Brooks once said he realized with Blazing Saddles that it was time to take two eyes the way Picasso had done it and put them on one side of the nose. He wanted to go all the way, and he did. I just got everything out of me, all my furor, my frenzy, my insanity, my love of life, and hatred of death. Think of it, not fear, but hatred of death. I've always loved that. To be afraid is one thing. Fear makes people lash out. It makes them take fewer risks. It makes everything smaller. But to hate death? That is an act of defiance. In an interview, Mel said, "Writing is simply one thought after another dying upon the one before. Where would I be today if it wasn't for Nikolai Gogol? You wouldn't be laughing at Young Frankenstein, because he showed me how crazy you could get, how brave you could be." And I love Mel Brooks. How could you not? Happy birthday to one of the greatest ever to do it. Long live the king. I did have to edit and shorten that Mel Brooks story because it ran very long and we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.